The reading for today is from John Greer's book, Seeing, Knowing, Being, A Guide to Sacred Awakenings. There is a well-known story from the Sufi tradition about a man who lost his keys in the alley one night. He was searching for them under a lamppost when a neighbor asked him, "What are you doing?" He replied that he was looking for his keys. Asked where he lost them, he pointed to the other end of the street. "Why aren't you looking over there?" the surprised neighbor wanted to know. The man responded, "The light is better here." We are just as foolish today, searching for meaning and answers to the deepest mysteries of our lives, where the light is best, though we know in our hearts that we lost the keys to truth somewhere else. The spiritual wisdom for which we yearn is not to be found under the bright light of science or reason. Rather, we must follow the advice of the mystics and search for it within. I have two collections of children's books about bears. One of them is Paddington. Now, if you're not familiar with Paddington, Paddington came from Lima, Peru to England and found a family. If you read the Paddington's books, they are about a bear who has many adventures, or maybe I should say misadventures. Paddington's life is always involved in some kind of upheaval, whether it's getting lost in a store while buying pajamas, or stepping in a paint bucket, or creating havoc when he bathes. Whatever it is, Paddington, if nothing else, is a very humorous and interesting bear. The second collection of children's bear books I have is Corduroy's stories. Now, if you noticed from the little story about Corduroy today, Corduroy is kind of a really ordinary bear. Corduroy doesn't have the huge misadventures and adventures that Paddington has. That's not to say that he doesn't have an interesting life. He does. It's just more like the life that you and I have. It's the everyday life. It's the life where you get up, wake up your kids, wake up your spouse, feed your pets. The life where you figure out, do I have matching socks to go to work? And that kind of thing, where we just go through life making sure we have done what needs to be done. Just the ordinary life. I remember back in the 80s when there was existentialists were big. They were big in philosophy, big in psychology. And the question they asked was, what does it all mean, all these very ordinary things that human beings go through? And for a long time, the theory was that we're all in existential angst and we can't find meaning out of life. Well, I can happily report that is not true. Now, how do I know that's true? That it isn't true, that we do as human beings find meaning in our everyday life. How do I know that? Well, I know it because Hinselman and King did a lot of research on people looking for meaning. And in their article, Life is Pretty Meaningful, in the American Psychologist from 2014, they indicate that we as a people generally find meaning in our everyday activities and in our lives. Now, that's really good news. It's good to think about. They also explain how we do this. We do it in a social, environmental context. Now, what they're talking about, when I put it into plain English, is we find meaning in the hug we give a child, in the smile we give the clerk in the store, in the petting of a cat or a dog, in taking care of our grandchildren, in doing volunteer work, or playing lovely music for a church. We find significance in those things. We know that without them, life would be meaningful, meaningless, and that is why we do these things. We find it in taking care of the earth, in planting trees and maybe growing our own vegetables, in recycling. We know these things, mundane as they are, saving those coffee grounds for compost. Compost patch. We know those things are important. Our everyday lives are meaningful. Now, when I looked for what does meaning exist, I have to go back to Heinzelman and King's article. Essentially, a meaningful life is one that has significance and purpose to the person living it. It makes sense to the person living it. So there's no one from outside of you that can look around and say your life is meaningless if you think it's meaningful. If you think you have significance in your life, it does. It's not rocket science, as we were led to believe many years ago, that you had to go through 30 years of therapy to find meaning. We don't. And that's the good news. That makes me really happy, because I don't have to create artificial meaning. It's there in what I do every single day. And that is joyful to me. Now, when I talk about this, that we do this in connection to friends, we do it in connection to the earth. The one thing I do have to add, the one caveat is that loneliness, isolating oneself, can in fact lead to unhappiness and lack of meaning. So we do need to keep that social network going. Now you're going to ask, what about suffering? Suffering happens. Just when I think I've got my life together, I get fired, my child loses a job, the job I'm supposed to have doesn't start, somebody close to me gets a very serious, probably life-threatening illness. Maybe I develop some illness that I don't want to have. You develop some illness you don't want to have. Things happen. What happens to meaning in our lives then? I'm going to give you one little example. My pension was threatened. Now, I don't know about you, but I paid into my pension most of my adult life. To lose it was very frightening. But I went to a union meeting, and I'm sitting in this hall, and I'm not good at numbers, but I'll say with 200 people, all of whom may lose their pensions. Well, I looked around, and I looked at us, and I went, oh my goodness. We can do something about this. This is just our little group. And if we lose them, we can get together, we can develop co-ops, and my mind started racing with all the things we could do together to survive. Now, thank goodness, we have won some court cases, which indicates that we probably will not have the dire situation we once thought we were going to have. But when I was alone by myself It was a dire, frightening situation. But when I met with others, it changed and transformed. And that is the power of social context in changing meaning in one's life. So even in suffering, we can find meaning if we have others with us. Now, John Greer, in the reading that I did, talks about our keys, the keys to our inner life, the keys to our joy, the keys to meaning. And he warns us that we look all sorts of places for meaning, but right in front of us. Right to, we fail to look at the person right next to us that can help us put meaning in our life. I had an encounter where a woman in a store was going off. She was just yelling, and you know, it was Christmas time. And I'm in Macy's, and all I want is bed sheets. I'm not Christmas shopping. And this lady is just irate, because I don't know why she was irate. And the clerk is trying to calm her down, Everybody's standing in line while she's creating this. And I finally looked up at the clerk, and I just kind of smiled at her and went like this. She smiled back at me. And in that moment, we had that human connection that made the raving and ranting of this lady more, we could endure it better. We could deal with it better. Just because of that simple look between two strangers. So meaning is not hard to find. We can find it any place we look. But perhaps one of the most important things to do is to step back and have silence every day in our lives. I cannot remember the exact words, but I remember Pastor Sunshine standing right down there, and he looked up and he said, "How many of you have a period of silence every day in your life?" And I don't know how many people raised their hands. I know I did not. And I don't think a lot of other people did, because his next words were something like, I'm sorry, Jer's next words were something like, "No wonder we are in such confusion and chaos." Since Jer's saying that, no, is it G or Jer? Jer's saying that. Since those words from Pastor Sunshine, I have made sure that I have a period of silence every day. Even if it's 5 minutes. I don't sit in any particular posture. I don't do anything special. I just look out my window. Look at the sky. And just watch the clouds or lack of clouds. And you know what? Pastor Sunshine was right. My life has less chaos, less confusion, and more coherence. My life has more significance simply because of those few minutes a day. So the keys to meaning in our life are right in front of us. We don't have to search for them. Then how is it that we sometimes get so screwed up? At least I do. Maybe you do, but I do. In asking myself that, I had to think about purpose. Now, purpose and meaning are very closely connected, but I'm going to distinguish them in this way. Meaning is in your heart and your head. It's what you decide is significant. Purpose is about the result, the aim of our actions. The Buddhists call it being effective. If I've learned anything from studying Buddhism, it's stop actions that are ineffective. Harder said than done, because a lot of them are habits. We screw up our own lives because we're not clear about the purpose of our actions. An example. Suppose I believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and part of my meaning in life is that I want to look at every person, and when I look at them, I want to recognize their inherent worth and dignity. Important thing. Now, I'm going to give you two stories about how we can screw up and louse up the meaning in our lives, and then how do we get it correct. Okay. I was a young psychologist, and I was in charge of behavioral programming on a unit in a mental health hospital. And I had done everything right. Okay, I observed the staff. I observed the patients. I included the staff in writing the unit program so that it would be their program, not my program. And I did all the training we needed to do. And I even came in on midnight, so we were consistent if the kids get up. So all three shifts had the message, and we had input, changed it, got their final approval, got everybody to sign off. Hurrah, great psychologist now. And in my inexperience, I didn't realize things can still go wrong. Well, it did go wrong. So the next morning, after we had chaos one evening, we had our morning staff meeting, and I come in and I am upset. We have violated the program, which means we violated policy and procedure, which you never, never, never want to do when you work in a state facility. And I was upset. So we're all sitting down at morning meeting, and I start out and I read the riot act to the staff. I want to know who wasn't trained. Was there something about the training that wasn't good? Do we need more training? Is there something about the program not understandable? What were the reasons it wasn't followed? I get stony silence. Of course I got stony silence, but as a young psychologist, I didn't realize why I did. And I gave them what for. Then my boss continued the meeting. And afterwards, he said, "Dee, can I see you?" "Sure." So I go into his office, and he goes, "There isn't a word that you spoke this morning that was not the truth. It was all the truth. You, on your big white horse, spoke the truth. What was your purpose?" "Well, my purpose was to get good patient care." And what do you think the stony silence meant? That I screwed up? Yeah. Now, there I was saying, way before I ever knew about Unitarianism, that I wanted to acknowledge everybody's inherent worth and dignity. But my tirade about how they failed only made them feel terrible about themselves. It also undermined my purpose of getting good patient care, because once you give people a tirade like that, now I didn't shout, I don't want to give you the impression I shouted, despite the fact that it was truth, it didn't accomplish my purpose of getting good patient care, because I didn't have the staff with me. Now it was me against them, because I made them feel so badly about themselves. So it isn't enough just to know that life has meaning. We also have to be effective in putting that meaning into operation. And I definitely was not effective. Another example I can give you is again, when I was a young psychologist, I was a brand new psychologist at this time, and I was a school psychologist. And this happened in another state, so nobody will know any of these people. We had this kid who was a terror. I have never met in my entire life a more arrogant human being. Before the word entitled was common, this kid was the embodiment of entitlement. I don't want to take our time to tell you, but just imagine somebody who thought he was king. Also in a school that a lot of other kids sort of had this attitude, but not quite. It was so bad that the parents petitioned to have this kid removed from a middle upper class public school. You don't ever want parents to have to do that. And they presented it to the school board. So we had to do something. So we called in the parent because everything else had failed. And we're talking to the parent gently at this time and trying to explain exactly the situation. And suddenly, tears start rolling down the mother's face. And I said, well, do you understand? Your kid is so ostracized. He's totally alone. Nobody likes him because of the way he acts and his attitude. We don't want that for your child. We want him to be part of the group. And I'm thinking that's why the mother's crying. And I said, but maybe you can explain your tears. And she goes, when I grew up, nobody cared about me. I was the neglected child. I was the kid who nobody cared if they got A's. Nobody cared if they fell. I'd have to put my own Band-Aids on. Oh, I always had food. I had clothing. I had shelter. But I wasn't cared about. I was nobody special. And when I had kids, I was going to let my kid know he counted. He meant something. That is why I'm alive, is because I want children and I want to raise human beings to know they're worth something. Now, was she ill-intentioned? No. Was her meaning for her life wrong? No. She was a well-intentioned lady. But look at what happened in the way she carried it out. She wasn't clear on her purpose to put her meaning into effect. She had a very spoiled child who did not know the meaning of no. And because of that, instead of thinking he was special and a worthwhile human being, he thought he was a king and alienated everyone else. He thought he was super special. Better than everybody else. See, the woman was clear about her meaning, but her purpose in carrying out that meaning was screwed up. I like what the Buddhists say about knowing your meaning. Be clear about it. That's when they talk about clear thought. They also talk about right action, and that's they're talking about the purpose, about being effective in what one does. So effectiveness and, so meaning and effectiveness go together. Now, all of us have skills to be effective. And if we don't, we all have friends and we can ask. Maybe as I've gotten older, I put some of my pride away. And if I don't know how to do something, I ask. I remember after I retired, the first year was horrendous. My husband was sick, he was in and out of hospitals. I didn't have time to think about retirement. When it got better, I'm sitting home one day and I'm going, I've been given some brains, I have a huge education, I should be giving something back in the area of psychology. I should be teaching a course, I should be doing something. But I don't want to. I really don't want to. And I called one of my friends, and I was discussing this with her. She had been retired, I think, a couple of years, maybe a year longer than I. And she said, yeah, I went through that after I retired. But then I decided I worked hard all my life. I think the purpose of my life right now is to just enjoy it. Whoa. In Greer's book, he gives an example about a flower. Does a flower have to agonize about its meaning? It just is. We just are. That's our meaning. How we carry that out is our purpose. The last thing I want to talk about is our intent. Now, intent is our motivation. And I understood motivation. And we all understand what makes us tick, what makes us go, what makes us do things. But I didn't really get it till Pastor Sunshine introduced us to the Enneagram. Now, I know a lot about abnormal psychology. You want to know what, it'll pop out of my mouth. You could wake me up in the middle of the night, hit me and say, tell me about this, and I go blah, 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 okay? Ask me about normal psychology? Well, I took a course in developmental, let me see what I can remember from that. So this is all normal psychology, and it's fascinating to me. It also helped me realize that I can have meaning in my life, purpose, be effective, and if I don't understand my motivation, I can also get in there and mix up that pot and not be as effective as I want to be. And if Enneagram is about anything, it's about motivation. And I'm going to give you two simple examples about motivation. These both happened in my family. 1 year ago, one recently. Years ago, a relative was unmarried and pregnant. When she told her mother's response was, how could you do this to me? As I got to know her mother better, I realized that this woman was all about being the perfect mother. That was her motivation. She wanted people to look at her and say, what a good mother she was. More concerned, her motivation was her image. Several years later, another relative gets pregnant, unmarried, older, adult, but not real mature. So, it's kind of a funny story. Your mother takes her to get her tonsils operated. Doctor comes out and says, we can't operate on your tonsils. Why is that? Because you're pregnant. Not happy for someone who was on the pill. So yes, it can happen. So she has to call her mother and tell her mom, Mom, you're going to take me home, because I'm pregnant. Just graduated from college and I'm pregnant. Okay. You know what her mother said? How can we help you? Do you know what you want to do? Do you need help making a decision? What can we do for you? Two totally different motivations. One mother concerned about her image. The other mother concerned about her child. Now I should tell you, the second mother is a conservative Christian. So what her daughter did was not in her value system. I admire that woman, who happens to be my sister-in-law, more than I can say. How can we support you? How can we help? It is those moments of silence that let us look at what our motivation is. Sometimes my motivation's good, sometimes it's not so pretty. But we can also remember calling the friends to help us. One of my biggest sources of motivation in my life is this church. Each of you sitting in these pews help me all the time to be better, kinder, and when I screw up, to learn a little bit about forgiveness, because I see a lot of forgiveness in this church. For this reason, I would like us to close standing up. And singing our last hymn. But what I'd like us to do is, as you sing it, kind of look around and sing it to each other. Because this is what it's all about in finding meaning. So this is, if you need your hymnal, 1059 in the Teal hymnal, and Rachel will play it through once and then we'll sing it. I want to say before Rachel begins the postlude that this service would not have happened if Mary Johnson had not stepped in when the liturgist who volunteered had an emergency, if Ken and Joy had not put everything on slides and helped me with the music and led the music. So I want to thank everybody, and I want to thank Rachel for playing.